Mr. Incredible, do you have a secret identity?
Every superhero has a secret identity. I don't know a single one who doesn't. Who wants the pressure of being super all the time?
Welcome to the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast, Incredibles Retrospective Series.
Hello there.
Join Matt.
He's a disruptive influence, and he openly mocks me in front of the class.
Adam.
Hey, I had a mohawk. There's a lot about me you don't know.
Yeah, but a mohawk?
You didn't miss anything.
And Garrett.
I thought you renounced superhero.
Yeah, well, I renounced my renunciation.
As they save the podcast airwaves by going through the incredibly popular Pixar series starring a family of superheroes.
That's really cool!
Why did Matt want to do this series?
This is important. They are in trouble. It's up to us. To us, understand?
Will Adam put away memories of glowing Apple Watches long enough to cherish his time seeing both movies in theaters?
Okay, come out, num num cookie!
And does Garrett's reputation for hating children in film continue with this series?
Thing is, he wants us to bring you, too.
Find out the answers to these questions and so many more.
Who are you supposed to be?
Well, I'm Incrediboy!
What?
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Showtime.
Incredibles 2, released June 15th, 2018. Budget was $200 million. The box office take of $1.2 billion. And this was directed once again by Brad Bird. Well, audiences certainly showed up in droves for the anticipation for Incredibles 2, but was the 14-year wait worth it? Well, that question will be answered throughout the duration of this podcast. Boys, did you ever think, with all the industry talk of sequels and reboots and all this stuff, and with Pixar in particular, did you ever honestly think we would get an Incredibles 2?
I did not. And at this point, they had started sequelizing a lot of their stuff. The Incredibles was the Untouchables. You know, it seemed like they were not going to go back to that well. They did some shorts, they did other little things, but it almost was one of those near-perfect movies that just wasn't going to get a sequel to me. And Bird had done a Pixar movie after Incredibles, so I didn't think he was going to go back to the well. And I don't know if Disney kind of forced their hand or pushed, or the rumor of he had a great idea was true, but I was stunned when I heard this was coming out, because I never thought it would happen.
I'll say this. I think there's one reason and one reason only. We had another Incredibles movie, and it's one word. It's Tomorrowland. Brad Bird thought that he was going to go to Hollywood right after this was over, and he was going to be a well-respected director, which he was for a number of years. Matt, we covered Mission Impossible, the fourth one. We're going to cover it again when the new one comes out. And then he had Tomorrowland, which was a complete flop when it was released. I only know one person who is on this podcast in the world who actually likes that goddamn movie. So I think
that would
once
be me,
that movie,
everybody.
Yeah. I think once that movie came out and fell as hard as it did, I think Bird was the one who was like, you know what? I'm going to go back. I'm ready to do Incredibles. And I think this whole thing of him saying he has a grand idea for that, he just wanted to make sure he got it right before he started this, was bullshit. And that doesn't reflect my opinion on the movie. I just think that all of that was a spin, and Brad Bird came crawling back to Pixar once Tomorrowland landed the way it did.
You answered the cynical part of my brain that Tomorrowland was a considerable factor in Brad Bird ultimately returning to the Incredibles property. But let's jump in the Wayback Machine ourselves and remember that when Pixar signed Brad Bird, it was for a two-film deal. That second film did turn out to be Ratatouille, not necessarily a sequel to The Incredibles. And that came out in 2007. And they asked him right around the time of Ratatouille being released, would you consider doing an Incredibles 2? And he said, I have fragments of a story, but I don't necessarily have them all together. And that was kind of it. It was dormant in the discussion atmosphere outside of the fans. I do think this was the, of all the franchise sequels that Pixar has done, outside of Toy Story, Toy Story is kind of an outlier. I would say this was the most demanded by far. I don't think people were really clamoring for a sequel to Finding Nemo or a prequel to Monsters, Inc. The Incredibles was the one, though, that seemed to have the most champions and the largest fervor for doing another film. I think part of that is because it was left open for a sequel, certainly, but also the rise of the superhero movie genre in general becoming the dominant force in blockbuster filmmaking in the time that Incredibles, since its release. But it wasn't until 2013, which is post-Avengers, I think that's a key detail as well, they asked Brad Bird again. Now, he had already done Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, so he had another movie that was a big success outside of Pixar. And he said, yeah, I'll still do it. I love those characters, but I got to get everything to click together. And while publicizing those comments, he did mention that his idea for a sequel would be to have Bob and Helen switch roles, you know, Elastigirl being at the forefront. And then in 2014, Bob Iger did confirm that Pixar was working on an incredible sequel. It was also revealed that, yes, Bird was going to return as the creative force behind it. But Brad Bird did not start writing the film until April 2015, which is pretty close to when Tomorrowland was about to release, if I recall. Now, there were some factors that I think contributed to Tomorrowland bombing, outside of the fact that I don't think it's a very good movie, so I'm with you on that, Garrett. I understand the rationale of releasing that in the summer, but you put that in the same summer as Avengers Age of Ultron, which was, I would say, as anticipated as The Incredibles 2 eventually was. You're going to put yourself in a hole because it was released a couple weeks later. Jurassic World was a billion-dollar movie, which nobody expected. You had Mad Max, which was not the big box office juggernaut the Avengers was, but was anticipated. But yeah, Tomorrowland was, I would have released that more like October, November. I think it would have done a little bit better. But yeah, you're right. It was a disappointment, I think, creatively and certainly financially. However, and Adam touched on this last week, it's tough to distance the development of this film in unison with Pixar ultimately being acquired by Disney.
Yeah, because this movie is like the longest stretch that they did between sequels, correct? What was the other one? It was, Finding Dory. Finding Dory was 13 years. This is 14 years. And I do think you're absolutely right that the Disney acquiring Pixar was a huge part of why we finally ended up getting it. Because this was something that it kind of stood on its own. To call this anticipated, 14 years? Like, the people who saw Incredibles in 2004 were 14 years older. Like, I don't know who was really anticipating a sequel to something they saw as a kid.
I would push back against that, being that I was one of those people. But Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, and I don't even know. I think as well, it's people like me whose kids grew up watching it at home, because I watched it around the time we had kids, and then my kids grew up with the DVD. I mean, literally, I have a widescreen version and a square version, you know, the first edition of the DVD that came out. So I think I've got, at this point, three different versions of The Incredibles on disc. And, of course, I watched it on Disney Plus for this these discussions, because that's how it works. But I think you got an entire generation who grew up living in an Incredibles world of having it on TV, having it on the Disney Channel, having it movies at home, having it in theme parks, having toys, lunchboxes, and kind of being inundated with it. So even though you had some that grew up, you had a slew of kids who never had their own Incredibles movie to go watch at the movie theater. And I think that was a big part of it as well.
There's also the thing that Adam alluded to as well. This property never really went dormant as far as marketing or other iterations. You know, there was a comic book, there was a video game, once California Adventure rebranded the Incredicoaster. It was always in the cultural zeitgeist. It wasn't one of those things like, I think of a movie like A Bug's Life, which Pixar really, I don't want to say has ignored, because there was a attraction they put at Animal Kingdom, but I don't think that's a movie that's been as heavily branded and mass marketed as, say, The Incredibles.
That's a damn shame, because they had A Bug's Land at Disney California Adventure, and we freaking loved it. My kids grew up with it, because they had a Bug's Life area, and I'm going to, not to hit a side note here, but damn, I love A Bug's Life. But yeah, to your point, Cars is known as the most profitable brand out of Disney until, you know, Marvel. And Incredibles is a close second because, yeah, it's never gone away.
I have never seen A Bug's Life, but I tell you, and yeah, I know. I tell you who really champions that film is my future wife. She loves it. One of these nights, we're going to sit down, we're going to watch it together, but she's been clamoring for a sequel to that since that first movie was released. And so, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever see it, but I know it has at least one champion.
I liked it better when it was called Seven Samurai, and I'll leave it at that. But one thing you do have to take into account is that when The Incredibles came out, the first one, it was during the growing pains period of superhero movies. 14 years later, it was the genre. And you talk about overcrowding, this comes out the same year as Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. It had competition, which the first one did as well, because that came out the same year as Blade 3 and Punisher and Spider-Man 2. But my question was...
Nothing but four movies, though.
Yeah. But the question was, how is it going to stand up and stand out when the genre has become so overexposed in the minds of cynics? And the reality is just the sheer number of the quantity was drastically more than it was in 2004.
The fact you said you put a B at the beginning of how much this fucking movie made astounds me, because you're right. At that point, superhero films were saturating the fucking market. Like, you could not get away from them. So that was another thing. When this movie was coming out, I do remember it being touted and people were really looking forward to it. Mostly people who, Matt, you and I, the site that you and I were at the time. But I said the same thing. I'm like, what else do you have to say? You know, you said enough, and you had an animated version of The Watchmen, for God's sake. So you had stuff that you said already, and there was stuff taken from Civil War, and there was everything else. And now you're going to do another one of these in the midst of the huge boom that was the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah, I was one of those cynical people who was like, what the fuck else do you have to say that hasn't been said already by either you or Marvel?
You know who had something to say was Pixar, because they needed a hit. I mean, in a desperate way. Since the couple movies that had come out before this were poorly received and poorly received sequels. You know, you had Monsters University, which did okay, and then just dropped off a cliff. Inside Out was a big hit, and it just drew for a long time. Like, that one seemed to get the feels with everybody. But The Good Dinosaur, it was almost completely scrapped, and that almost, like, finished Pixar. It lost so much money. Finding Dory wasn't very well received. Cars 3 earned less than in its entire run than this made opening weekend. Coco grew to find its audience, but that came on the heels of Book of Life, which beat it to the punch. So it was like Pixar needed to reestablish that dominance, because it seemed to be floundering. And in my opinion, once Disney bought it, they had decided to put all their attention back in Walt Disney Animation and go back to trying to make Pixar second tier, where for the last 20 years it had been flipped the other way.
It's basically the inverse of Toy Story 2, where Toy Story 2 went through so many rewrites and so much conflict that it's amazing the movie is as great as it is.
Yeah.
The Good Dinosaur is the worst case scenario for that.
Yep.
But you're right. I as a moviegoer and as a Pixar fan, you look at when Pixar was the more dominant than Disney Animation, the early to mid 2000s. It really flipped into Disney's favor once they acquired Pixar. When you look at the movies they started making, like Wreck-It Ralph, Big Hero 6, Zootopia, those really felt like of the quality of Pixar's previous lineup.
Frozen.
Well, I don't want to talk about Frozen. We'll talk about Frozone, but I'm not talking about Frozen. Whereas Pixar, it became everything that they were not. With the exception of Toy Story, they did not make sequels to their established properties. And then all of a sudden, they started churning them out. Yes, you're right. Finding Dory, I don't know anyone who loves that movie, but it made a shitload of money.
Yeah, I say everybody went to see it, and it just, it's weird. But yeah, to your point, like, everybody goes, and I don't think anybody, when they think of Finding, nobody talks about Finding Dory. Talk about Finding Nemo. They redid the ride, the submarine rides, and it's still Finding Nemo. Like, they did Dory for, I think, a month and scrapped the screens and went right back to Nemo.
The weird thing about it is, and I think the same thing happened to Pixar that was happening to Marvel and eventually happened to Star Wars. The movies being released cease being events anymore. we were told that a new Pixar movie was coming out. It's like, oh, here comes another Pixar movie. Here we go. And especially when they started doing these sequels. At the time The Incredibles came out, we had hardly any sequels to any Pixar properties.
Toy Story 2 was the only one.
Okay. I said hardly any. I know Toy Story 2 was five years.
And that one almost doesn't.
Agreed.
That one almost doesn't even count because it was supposed to be direct to video.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying, was they were not saturating the market like they eventually did. And then eventually, again, the events stopped happening. But goddamn, everything I'm saying is muted, though, because this fucking thing made over $1 billion. So obviously, some people were really looking forward to it.
It was an every year thing. It was like next year's Pixar movie, next year's Pixar. So you didn't have the anticipation. You just knew something was coming. But then when you look at, I think, the commonalities that the last like couple have to, you know, in common, every sequel took the side character and flipped it. Every single one. Cars 2 was suddenly about Mater. Finding Nemo sequel was suddenly about Dory. Monsters University was about Mike. Every single movie had the exact same conceit. And kids don't care, but adults start to go, maybe I don't need to go see this one with my kids.
That's a very prophetic statement given the movie we're talking about today.
Now, yeah, I love Cars 3.
Oh, God. I've never thought of that point, and it's further highlighted by this movie. But I thought that made sense to put Elastigirl at the forefront for this one, because, you know, she's as important to the first movie as Bob, but it's really his character arc that's the driving force of the movie, not...
You know my cynical idea as to why she's at the forefront of this movie?
Because Wonder Woman made so much money?
No. Because John Lasseter was ousted.
Oh.
A couple years before this was coming out. And I think, not necessarily sexual harassment, but for the way he treated employees.
Misconduct.
Not sexual harassment, just grabbing their thighs.
Yeah. Which you can do. I mean, that's okay. No, I'm kidding. No, he was ousted. And I think a lot of it was the Kathleen Kennedy idea of putting women in power and putting them at the front of this. Now, I could be completely off, and Brad Bird could have had a point of saying, I just wanted to flip the roles that were established last time. But that's kind of my, as I was watching this, I could not stop thinking about that.
Well, it's hard not to think that given history and the other properties they were doing at the time. So I do think there's some traction in that thought process. But I was surprised. I mean, when the movie came out, and I promise everyone we'll actually talk about the movie in a little bit. it was a packed theater.
I expected it to be big, but I'd seen the box office grow since Avengers was the first one, and it broke that $200 million. And I'd seen the last several years of just the exponential increasing of the box office and the packed theaters, the multiple screens, Disney's insistence on the biggest, most screens at a Plex. But I couldn't believe how full this was. And this was an opening weekend, you know, whole family getting there early enough to sit dead center screen. And yeah, this was a packed ass house of old people, of middle-aged people, of young people. I mean, this was a full-blown four-quadrant movie.
For all its success, I think the one thing that hurt it was Into the Spider-Verse coming out a couple months later. And that movie, much like The Incredibles 2, far exceeded expectations to the point where that won the Oscar over this for Best Animated Feature. But yeah, so the movie came out, and it, you know, I mentioned it did really well critically, commercially. But this is only the second time I've watched it.
Interesting.
That's not to preview my thoughts on the movie, but with 14 years going by and having to, at the time I was still writing, you know, we were doing our thing over at the other site. So I had to be on top of a lot of other things. So I didn't do a lot of repeat viewings. But now that I have kids of my own, I was really curious to see how this would play for me now.
Yeah, and to the surprise of nobody, this was my first time watching this movie. I popped on the Disney Plus, and I watched it by myself, and I took a lot of notes. And I definitely have thoughts, but I had literally no intention of watching this movie. If it wasn't for this podcast, I probably wouldn't have never watched it.
Yeah, I mean, this was obviously, as I said, a theater watch for us. I think we watched it once when I bought the discs, because still need to, you know, keep up with my Disney physical media, and... this was, I think, my third time watching it. So, again, not preview my thoughts as well, but yeah, saw it in theater, saw it once when we bought it, and then here we go.
It's been collecting dust ever since.
Yeah, I love how we got three viewings, a second viewing, and a first viewing.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, let's get into the movie. We open with, you talk about like putting me right back in 2004 when you hear the music kick in and it's the Pixar logo, but it's got that red slash black aesthetic mm-hmm. that matches the suits. It was pretty cool. Like I was happy to see, it felt like no time had passed at all, even though it'd been 14 years.
Yep, they're putting you right back. Now, does this take place in the 50s?
So, the movie, this franchise has never put a timestamp on when this takes place, because it's that combination of future and retro. Although I will say that's more prevalent in the first one than it is here. This one feels a little bit more contemporary in a lot of ways.
I don't know. We have some references to stuff that was on TV around that time, too. So that's why I was asking, like, if this was really like a 60s, is this supposed to be like a 60s aesthetic or what we have going on here?
Well, it plays on the 50s and 60s because the movie starts with like a CIA interrogation, which I was not expecting the movie to do.
No.
Of Violet's crush, Tony, being interrogated by the guy who's like the superhero liaison for that secret program of relocation. He's telling mm-hmm. him, tell me what happens. And it's a movie that, you talk about a direct sequel, you don't get more direct than picking up directly where the first one left off with the Underminer as the prologue for the movie.
Yeah, that was weird. I was not expecting them to Simpsons this up. You know, I thought maybe we'd get some aging going on with these characters. But no, we are picking up literally hours after the last film from 14 years ago.
For those that have listened to our Planet of the Apes retrospective, it's almost the same thing where we get to a sequel literally right where the first one left off. And that's exactly what yeah. we got here. And I was like, man, they know how to, my boys know how to schedule this right, because it's exactly what I'm getting with Apes. But now, before that, the Disney logo that goes in, you know, the castle and all that, I am a sucker for the alternate logos they started doing around this time. So they did it with Tron, they do it with this. They do it with a lot of movies. I just got to say, as a Disney fan, I fucking love the alternate logos. I think it's such a cool little piece that sets you off in a world right away.
And if they were going to do a direct sequel, which is what this is, you had to remind the audiences, especially 14 years later, you have a whole new generation of people who are watching this. And I'd imagine there's a couple who've never seen it, being the first one. So I like that they're picking up, and it's literally the ending of the movie from Tony's perspective, where he sees, you know, the Parr family suiting up and they're going to go stop the Underminer, which, for the record, was a video game that served as the sequel to the first one. That was much like what Disney would do with Star Wars. They said that does not matter anymore. This is the only canonical piece.
And this shocked me. I mentioned last week that for some reason I remembered the Underminer being in this movie, but you know what? I realized minutes after I put this on, I had never seen this movie, and maybe I heard a discussion about it or something where we talk about the Underminer, where someone talks about the Underminer, but this is literally the only time we see this character this entire movie. So I don't know if, you know, in future sequels, we're going to see him pop back up or whatever, but that was a pretty big disappointment to me that we don't even get this fucking Saul. We see this character, he comes up and, you know, there's some good fighting going on here. I'm liking the scene, but this is the only time we fucking see this character, and then he's gone.
Made me laugh because of your reaction to the Underminer at the end of the first film and eye rolling at the Ratzenberger intro just for that. And then this thing starts off with a 10-15 minute Underminer scene.
Yeah.
I didn't mind it because to me it feels like a Bond opening. You know, you get that opening scene to kind of put you in the feel of the movie and then those people are gone.
That's a fantastic point. And I want to point something out right now. The animation in this movie is fucking phenomenal. The advancements in 14 years, I mean, this thing pops off that screen, and it looks so much better. I'm not trying to diss the 2004 animation all that much. I think that one holds up pretty well, but the animation in this is seamless. It looks amazing. Like, they did some really good work on this, and all the technical people get some major props from me on this film.
Well, the thing that benefits is that Pixar had a lot more time to experiment with working with humans as your primary characters. And also, technology really caught up. Everything looks a lot slicker in this, but it still has that, I don't want to say toyetic look, but I like how everything's a lot shinier and a little bit more pristine. The character models are a bit more streamlined. Kind of reminds me of when, and Adam will know what I'm talking about, when they went from Batman the Animated Series to the New Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And everything got a bit more simplistic and slicker, but it's still in that universe. Because even you look at their costumes, they're much brighter in this. You know, it's a much more stark red. But yeah, I like how it's picking up directly where the first one left off. They're having to stop the Underminer. And again, it's so weird. It's so weird watching superhero movies where they actively save civilians during a big action sequence.
Oh my god, here we fucking go.
But that's what the whole, like, this whole movie is about, like, collateral damage and the perception of superheroes. I mean, it's playing on things that other films of the genre, Man of Steel, Captain America Civil War, Age of Ultron, you know, it's tackling things that that other contemporary superhero movies were doing at the time.
Collateral damage. I'll show you collateral damage.
You know what? I don't think Brad Bird had DC or Marvel in mind when he did this. I find that to be purely coincidental. Because these are characters that we established last film. They're out to save people, you know? Mr. Incredible, like, that was his whole thing, was he wanted to get back out there and do it, and nobody was letting him do it. And by the way, I thought we established at the end of the last film that superheroes were allowed again. Now we're being told that they're not?
No, it's never said. At the end of the first one, it's never said.
It's never said, but I just got the impression that they were. So we're back in this fucking hole again, where, you know, superheroes are now illegal. So I like the scene. I like the way the film starts off. But when we get to the plot, I'm going to have things to say.
Violet makes the critical mistake of removing her mask, so she is exposed to Tony, which leads to his memory getting wiped during that interrogation, where they do a, like, laser imprint into his forehead. Kind of like the neuralizer from Men in Black.
Yeah, that's what I thought of.
Not just because the Dicker is animated to look like Tommy Lee Jones, if you notice. Yep. They managed to stop it from obliterating City Hall, but the Underminer gets away, so I wonder if they ever make a third movie, which we'll talk about. He might as well be your stereotypical bank robber that a lot of Spider-Man villains were when they first started.
Yeah, I think Adam hit it, though. I think this is the Blofeld of the series. If they do another one, he'll pop up here and there, you know, and he'll be fought, and then they're going to discard him for the next one.
If they do a three, it'll be the child of the Underminer. He'll have a kid that'll be fighting Jack.
Well, I have things to say about a potential third movie once we get to the end, because I think there's something there, which I'll talk about. But they don't save the day completely, because the villain gets away, so they're interrogated by the government stooges saying that, yeah, did you stop him? No. Did he get away? Yes. So they're like, what do we do? So it turns out that the relocation program that was established as part of the, I guess, plea bargain from the first movie is that with it shutting down, they're not going to have financial assistance anymore. Nice bit of continuity, because their house got destroyed at the end of the first movie.
Yeah.
So they're relocated to a motel for 2 weeks.
My favorite reference in this movie happens at this point, where they are in room number 220. 220 is the same room that the Freelings went in at the end of Poltergeist. So I thought that was a wonderful reference that I caught right away. And
yeah, Craig T. Nelson, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I love that reference. I thought it was brilliant. That got me cheering.
You know what? That's from somebody who loves movies and knows it. I catch every A113 reference, but I never would have caught that one. Wow. Yeah.
Thank God it wasn't 237.
Yeah, I was scared of something like that. I was scared it was going to be like 217 or the obvious one, but, you know, as a huge, huge, huge fan of Poltergeist in my top 10 films of all time. I knew it right away, and that got me popping.
I'm going to have to watch that movie one day. But, Garrett, yeah. to your point, did you save them? No. Did they get away yet? It seems like the complete events of the Incredible Family saving everybody from Syndrome is ignored, though.
Yeah.
Because, and we don't know exactly how much time passed between that event at the end of the last movie and then the final scene, which is at school at a track meet, you know, yada yada. So it's a slightly different place in time. But to act like these people didn't save the world and shouldn't be out and about is suddenly completely ignored. And I can't get past that at the beginning of this, that they're put back into hiding again. It's just, I don't know. Now, again, it's a trope of spy movies. Bond gets, you know, gets his license to kill revoked every single film and has got to go get it, you know.
Yeah.
But when you're watching them back-to-back in quick succession like we are, I think it just sticks out more that I'm like, they just saved you all from Syndrome.
Yeah, Syndrome's not even referenced. He's referenced in this one time.
The time jump is 3 months from the climax of the first one into the track meet.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a title card that even says that. I can't remember exactly, which is bad because I saw this movie a week ago. So the family is sort of, there's a certain amount of unknown where neither of the parents are working. They're only in this motel for another 2 weeks. That's the best he could do. And there's sort of a conflict about what is the right thing to do. But they're talking about, you know, what was doing the right thing and saving people. Does that supersede breaking the law? Should they go public? Like, they're having the same conversation that is kind of built upon the first movie.
Yeah. I will say I do like these conversations. I don't think there's really enough of them, which is weird to say in a movie that, God, is even longer than last week's film. And I had a problem with last week's. I have things that I have down here that it should have been cut. But yeah, I wish there was more of this, honestly. I wish there was more thinking about, you know, the family unit and things in these conversations. Because I do like when Craig T. Nelson and Holly Hunter have these conversations. Now, it's 14 years later. Craig T. Nelson, I will say, everybody sounds the same. You know, I don't think that the day has passed. And that's the beauty of animation. The beauty of animation is you can take people who you used years ago and put them on. And with some modulation, you can get their voices almost the exact same. And I don't hear any difference between either of their voices. And they're 14 years older. You know, Craig T. Nelson's no spring chicken. You know, the guy's getting up there. And I think vocally, everybody's back except for Dash. I guess he aged a little bit, so they had to recast him.
It's 14 years later. Like, he's
yeah,
out, like,
exactly. Yeah. So they did have to recast that. But other than that, I'm enjoying everybody being here. Even Sarah Vowell, who's like in her 40s, is back on there too.
The vocal talent does an absolutely superb job. And even the replacement they got for Dashiell, like, he doesn't stand out as different. Like, that's a perfect voice match.
Yeah, it's pretty close, yeah. But I mentioned one of my problems. Dash gets nothing to do with this movie.
No, he does not.
Which is disappointing because this conversation is a culmination of his arc from the first one in a lot of ways. And I appreciate that Violet gets more to do, and you could argue has some of the best stuff in the movie, but it's disappointing that they don't have anything for Dash to do besides yell and act like...
Mess with remotes. Yeah. Like, that's his arc, is he learns how to use fucking remotes. You know, we're going to see in this movie, he's going to have put the sofa in the pool and a whole bunch of other shit with the remote later, and then he learns later, by the end of this movie, how to do it effectively. And that's it. That's really all he has to do. I agree with you, Matt. I think that was a big mess.
A lot of the trailers, a lot of the marketing is pretty much the Dash lines. And if you've seen the trailers, you get most of it, because that's what he's got to do.
And I also think... I would have liked this movie to have taken place a couple years later, because I would have liked to have seen them aged up, the kids aged up a bit more. You know, you have Violet in college, and you have Dash as that really, especially because he's an allegory for ADHD. Because, you know, being a teenager is hard enough. How do you deal with a kid who's got super speed and, you know, has the attention span of a raccoon? But
we're going to see a raccoon later on.
I said that intentionally.
Oh, I thought, okay.
So they put the kids to bed, they're talking outside, and Frozone shows up, who was in the prologue, but he's sort of taken off screen by a driver who represents this businessman. So he shows up to Helen and Bob with this offer to go meet with him, which they accept because, quite frankly, they have no better options.
No better options, and this is one of the characters. I know we all love Samuel L. Jackson, but cut Frozone out of this movie. He has zero purpose. Him and another character I'll mention later. There's no need for Samuel Jackson to be in this movie other than for him to collect yet another fucking paycheck.
Well, I have a theory. He had just finished his shooting post-credit scene for Avengers Infinity War. He just walked across the street, got in the booth, said his lines, and left.
Probably not wrong about that.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's one of the returning characters that I feel like, unfortunately, much like Dash. Obviously, you can't cut Dash out of the movie because he's part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But Frozone, you could have excluded, and I would have missed his presence, but at the same time, he has no real functionality.
Exactly.
No, but he is the only connection to the Parr family outside of Edna that we get in this movie.
Yeah, that's true. But they go to LexCorp, DevTech, excuse me. I'm like, yeah, that's a lazy name. DevTech?
Yeah, where they meet not James Woods.
Yeah, and so Adam, you talked about what's great about Pixar for so long was that they didn't get people who were famous at the time. They cast Bob Odenkirk because Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul were so popular.
Not only that, they cast Catherine Keener in this because she was in Get Out, which is about a psychic. pick. This, I agree with you, Matt. This is the first time the casting really was too much on the nose for me.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And it's a bit like I make the joke about James Woods because I don't hear Bob Odenkirk. I hear because I see James Woods. that's who this is for me. And that would have been the person to play it, but God knows he's gone such a fucking whack job. There's no way anybody at Pixar is going to work with the guy. But yeah, this is when you get voice casting decisions based on popularity, where it used to be, yeah, we have good talent who can voice act that are not people in the zeitgeist. You know, they're not people out there getting press. They're just great talent to come in and work with us, other than maybe like Tom Hanks. You know, but he wasn't a voice guy, so it wasn't that. But you look at who Pixar gets in behind the booth, and it's the antithesis of Disney and DreamWorks putting names on a poster of the vocal talent. And this is when Pixar starts to slide that way.
It doesn't help that he has so many of the physical mannerisms that Saul Goodman has on Breaking Bad / his own show, specifically the finger pointing, and it's Bob Odenkirk's voice. He's not putting on a real affectation. He's just speaking normally. And he's animated so much to look like him that I find it immensely distracting. He does a good job. Like, I don't think he phoned it in by any means, but I don't think there was a lot of care put into his character.
I think he's doing what's being asked of him. I think that's the way that they wrote the character. So I think that's a problem with the way that the character is written and directed and the functionality of it. You know, I just think that's, of all the care that's put into certain parts of this, and we'll get to some other ones. This one is just, it's functional because of where it needs to go, and that's kind of where the creativity was left with him.
I call bullshit on Brad Bird saying he wanted to wait till he had the perfect idea before he did this movie, because all I see him doing in this movie, and I'm going to call this out right now, is inverting everything. We have a sequel, we got to have a woman be the villain. We have a sequel, we got to have the woman being the person who goes out and saves people. This is a movie that is made because of sequelitis at Pixar, which we covered, you know, the first 30 minutes or so of this podcast. The most disappointing thing I found about Incredibles 2 is the lack of creativity that went into this movie.
So I think I don't feel as strongly as you do, and I think that'll be reflected once we get to the wrap up. But I do think there is a portion of this movie that feels tacked on, and it's everything with the villain, which we'll get into as the movie develops. But I will say, it's also worth noting, this movie had a year of production taken away in the writing process because they rushed Toy Story 4 into production. And I think because if you listen to Brad Bird, the villain pitched for this movie was strictly artificial intelligence.
Oh, that could have been so good, especially considering people looking at their screens in this movie. Oh, my God, that would have been amazing as opposed to the Bane villain we see for like two scenes.
Yeah, so that was a rewrite. And I think that's clear because the screenslaver's speeches don't really match the person under the mask's motivation. There's a huge conflict of interest, which we'll talk about. But speaking of which, we are introduced to Evelyn Dever, Evil Endeavor, which is a dead giveaway if you're paying attention.
So how long?
Evil Endeavor? I never caught that.
Her name is Evelyn Dever.
That's amazing.
Evil Endeavor. Which, that's fun. That's cute and funny.
Yeah, that's a very Bond type of reference.
Oh yeah, that's like Holly Goodhead.
You know, but my 8-year-old seeing this in a movie theater the first time, I think looked over at me and went, "That's the bad guy, right, Dad?"
So that's the universal problem with this kind of villain. You only have two suspects, unless it was a character that we have never seen, but the movie's not set up that way. And like this movie follows the Scooby-Doo principle of it's two people and it's always the less likely option or the less obvious option.
But it's even done in the character design.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the way that, oh, I don't care how I look. This is how my hair is going to be, how I'm going to dress. I'm going to, like, everything about this is, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's written by Brad Bird. Like, I just don't get the same person writing the first one and the second one. Like, this feels written by committee to prove a point.
It was written by AI.
Written by a Reddit message board.
Yeah, I don't find the writing to be a sharp in this one. I'll call that out, too. Again, I think there's a real lack of creativity here, and I find a lot of this disappointing when I come back to this movie. When I come to this movie and I see that, you know, Brad Bird waited 14 years to do this, And I'm starting to see why. I just don't think he had the correct sequel idea in him, especially a movie that's over 2 fucking hours, for God's sake.
I just don't think it was done. I think ideas were there, and I think it still needed some more time to cook. You know, not to go back to Ratatouille. You know, anyone can cook. Not everyone can be a great chef.
I haven't seen that one.
It's fine at best. He's got some ideas, but I think, to Matt's point, you know, taking a year off the production schedule, changing things around, I think a lot of things were animated, written, and then it was like, nope, go into the booth and these are your new lines, because I don't think things match up to the potential. I think the first one is so sharp, so good, and even for all its flaws, and God knows I had to hear about it at the beginning of this, Tomorrowland has messages in it that are important and I think really hit, and I think this coming on the heels of that, those messages just are left out.
Yes, Tomorrowland has messages, but it's the equivalent of being hit in the head with a sledgehammer.
Yes, it is.
Although I will say, this movie, instead of a sledgehammer, it's a steel chair. So it doesn't hurt as much, but it's still very obvious.
Yep.
So what's his pitch? So he tells them that when I was a kid, you know, my father was this illustrious friend of the public. I get the sense he was a politician, befriended all the superheroes, but when they were put into hiding, he called them, they didn't answer, and he got shot. Which, again, I always, you know, these movies are considerably more violent than a lot of Pixar's ilk. I mean, to see someone get, like, a gun actually get fired and kill somebody, even for the confines of Pixar, is still pretty surprising.
It really surprised me. Yeah, that was like the dead body last week. Like, I was like, holy shit, like, they put this in a Pixar film.
I'll say they did everything but drop pearls here to kill this family.
That actually would have been funny if he got shot and he was holding a pearl necklace.
They got the bat phone. In a little bit, we're about to get a bat cave, you know, exit. He's showing some love from more than just the same heroes he did last time. There seems to be some, like, DC pushes here.
Yeah. They take something from the Fantastic Four and actually use it that the first one did not. And a little bit later, hint, hint, it involves an auctioneer. But he mentions that, you know, my dad died because the superheroes went away and I want to change perception. So his pitch is Elastigirl is going to serve as the test subject or the focal point because she has caused the least collateral damage, which actually made me laugh when Mr. Incredible has the folder in front of him and he's trying to explain. He's still earnest, but he's also, he looks at things in a binary way, good versus evil. Whereas his wife, you know, to match her superpower, is a lot more flexible with how she perceives the world.
Yeah, and I feel like this is the only reason for that opening scene, right, is to show just how bumbling Mr. Incredible is in that scene. I mean, he does almost nothing to help in that course of the fight with Underminer. So this is the payoff right here.
So he gives them the opportunity to think it over. They go home and talk about it. And Bob is so desperate to get back out there, but he realizes that, you know, I had my shot in the first one, so I'm going to let her do this, and I'm going to stay at home with the kids and prove that it's being a stay-at-home parent is easy in his perception. And as we'll find out, he is dead wrong.
Yeah.
This is me in freaking 2020 furloughed and staying home for a couple months with a kid.
I thought this scene was one scene of Mr. Incredible holding Jack-Jack up to a freaking air blower away from being Mr. Mom. That's what I thought of when I saw it. I was like, was he going to take him to a strip club? Like, these scenes of him trying to integrate, I don't know. It just felt weird. I wasn't too into these scenes.
Well, we'll talk about later on. They get relocated to this luxurious mansion with, for some reason, there's trap doors under the furniture, which makes me laugh.
Yeah.
The water features are so overdone. But yeah, Dash's arc is he learns how to use a remote.
Yeah, but you know what? You mentioned that water. And then that goes back to the animation. The water and everything in this just looks so fucking beautiful. It's just like we mentioned, I think in a previous Toy Story retrospective we did, Matt, that it's hard to get humans and water down in these movies in animation. For somehow, some way they did it, man. Like when they show that waterfall, I think that was just a way to show off the animation.
Well, yeah, because in the context of this house and the architecture, it serves no functionality.
Exactly, yeah.
I love these designs, though. I think it harkens back to the first one. This is some of those Art Deco Southern California homes that you get down there. I absolutely love the design. There's a restaurant they go to later. I've been to that exact same restaurant. So I enjoy quite a bit. I could use a little less of that. I could use a tightening up of everything, but I have fun here at the house. The Mr. Incredible with the kids feels just so on the nose for me. So I'm relating to it even more now than I did in 2018. So I remember not caring for it, but I enjoy it a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, the animation, you could tell they spent 14 years on it. I just wish they spent 14 years on the script to go along with it.
So Helen goes to New Urbum, but not without getting her own Elasticycle. Which, this is one of those things where this movie really feels like the Disney mantra of create vehicles for toys.
Yes. This is a toy. Yep.
I will say it is pretty cool, though. I do like the way, like, she integrates with the motorcycle. And there are times when, like, she stretches as she's riding it to get over certain obstacles and things. I thought this was a cool scene, but you're right. It's just to show off another toy.
But I want to know who in the animation department went, hey, you know how there was a few comments about the shape of Miss Incredible last movie? How far can we push this? Because, I mean, Jesus, this is like Catwoman getting on the freaking bike cycle in Dark Knight Rises. So often we're looking at, like, a just trunk of her ass on this bike. That's enough that I'm like, okay.
I thought this movie came out after John Lasseter left Pixar.
It's just, one, I love curves, but it feels a little like, okay, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, just a little too far.
Yeah, this is starting to approach like Jessica Rabbit territory, where it's like you're being way too promiscuous.
But yeah, Garrett, to your point, I do love the suit. You know, I like the new design of it and all that. I like that the bike splits. The animation in this scene is fluid and gorgeous. I think, though, that we get a couple action scenes and every action scene, like the rest of this movie, is too long. I mean, animation by itself, if you cut 10 minutes, you save yourself millions of dollars. And I can't believe at no point somebody there went, hey, you're going to be having to keep to a runtime here.
You touched on my biggest critique of this movie is I think the action scenes go on way too long. Even the prologue, this climax. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, they're visually impressive by any part of the pun, stretch of the imagination. But there are also things that we've seen numerous times in superhero films. So I appreciate the nostalgic look at it, but the first one was making much more of a point. And this one, it's weird saying this, the weakest parts of the movie are the superhero components.
To your point, I think it's because it goes on so long. They start and you're energized and you're like, oh, cool. But you don't keep that energy. You don't keep me engaged throughout the entire action sequence. And you have to.
So she has to stop this runaway train from crashing. God, we've seen this in movies.
Oh, we just saw it last movie.
Yeah.
The Simpsons shtick. The Simpsons monorail.
Yeah, this is the Epcot monorail, so the people mover.
Tomorrowland people mover, yep.
Yeah. So she saves the train, but notices that the driver was under some form of hypnosis that's marked the screen slaver. All right, I got to talk about this right now. A lot of cliches I hate in movies. Sky portals being probably number one, as I mentioned over the years. Mind control is number two, because it is such a lazy plot device. Where why are things happening? Because they're possessed. And the villain has omnipotent power because of it.
That was another disappointment with me. How interesting would it have been to have this character, Evelyn, convince Mrs. Incredible to do her bidding without mind control? Like, that would have been something that would have been scary, and it would have been something that would have been different. But no, we're going to give the excuse that it's going to be mind control. And I kind of get it, because they want to get to the conclusion where the kids are the ones who save the day. And I get that. But at the same time, you're right. It's very, very, like the rest of the script, very lazy to make the heroes do the bidding with mind control. I can't stand that conceit. I'm with you.
One, I can't believe the movie that I just watched recently this week about mind control that took all the impetus away from a villain. So we'll be talking about that in the future, but I was already
You
watch Black Widow?
Oh, God, that's another one. If you are going to make a point that screen time is bad, don't do it in a media format that you play on screens. Mm. You could tell they were going down a route about limiting screens. It's a screen slaver. Screen time, kids, getting too much screen time, too much TV, too much pads. Well, guess what? I've watched this on a big screen. I've watched this on a phone. I've watched this on a TV. So I've seen it on three different screens. Yes, we are the screen slavers. There's no subtlety whatsoever with that. Yeah, I don't, maybe they got the trademark cheat, so they decided to keep it in. But that's something that goes up on a whiteboard that gets erased.
Well, here's the thing. I think that's one of the most interesting parts of this movie.
Oh, is yeah, the if they kept part. It.
But, yeah, but they don't go anywhere with it. And that's the problem. You build it up, build this thing up as, you know, I want to have the perfect idea. And you introduce this idea, which is a great idea. But yet you drop the ball by concentrating on the other stuff. And again, keep saying it, it's lazy. It's a lazy, lazy, lazy bit of screenwriting that Brad Bird, this movie made over $1 billion. So I'm not going to say he should be ashamed of himself, but man, this is just the laziest of the lazy.
We have the ability to control people through screens. Guess what? That's not what you're doing by the end of this film.
Exactly.
You're not controlling people. You're a few people. So it's just... Mm-hmm.
So this has also a big, massive problem. When you find out who the villain is, you're like, okay, why did you waste all that time of following along with this elaborate plan instead of just doing this immediately? It also doesn't help that the design of the character in and of itself is just a black, skin-tight outfit with Bane's mask from Dark Knight Rises.
Bring out the Gimp!
Kept expecting Tom Hardy's voice to have come out of this. Yeah, this a Bane rip, which, you know what? I have no problems with that. I just have a problem with them just dropping this conceit.
Well, the problem is also for a sequel. I know Syndrome's a tough act to follow, but it's no contest the amount of commentary. Like, Syndrome is also a huge commentary on toxic fandom, whereas this starts out as one thing, and then it's undercut and becomes something else. I think everything with Screenslaver just does not work for me in any capacity.
That's kind of surprising, Matt. I was really expecting to fight over this because I was expecting you to say this was what worked last time, so we're going to say it this time. And I was going to fight with you over the fact that this was just pretty much a rehash of that first film. So what you're saying is you're not having fun with this either.
Well, the villain is not a rehash. It's trying to do something different because it's also Buddy Being Syndrome is a reveal, not a twist. This has the Disney trope of twist villains, which they had done for like a decade at this point. So I was already aware it's going to be Evelyn well before it's actually called. There was no surprise, and I'm enjoying the action. I think I like this movie more than you do. In fact, undoubtedly so, based on your comments. But the villain, I think, is one of the strongest things in the first movie, and it's arguably the weakest component here.
Yeah, and let me clear up. I wasn't saying that the villain was a rehash. I'm saying the movie itself is a rehash of last week's film.
No, I don't think the problem is it's a rehash. I think the problem was the stuff that's actually about the human conflict in the first one, you know, a guy's midlife crisis, it's accentuated by the superhero aspect. Because the first one's also about using superheroes as an allegory for being gifted, whether that's academically, intellectually, being exceptional. In this one, it plays like they're just regular superheroes. Like, it should set up comparing superheroes to, like, the Wikipedia effect of Screenslaver, where we're, rather than using our own brains, we rely on machines to tell us information that we should know. And superheroes being that equivalent of a quick fix. But that's not what the villain's actually about.
I don't know. I think the movie itself is pretty much last week's film inverted. And that's going to probably be my review of the entire film.
So while Helen is undertaking all of these assignments to try to boost popularity, Bob is having to struggle with everything from a daughter who's rejected over Tony having his entire memory wiped, not just the fact that she's a superhero. And my favorite joke in the movie, new math.
Great joke. And I also did like the touch of Ellen going to the fridge and pulling the ice cream out while being invisible, you know, because we talked about last week, you know, the invisible girl. My favorite joke's coming up, but yeah, new math got me laughing too, because I know two people in this podcast who have kids and they probably have had to go through this of having to talk math with them. And I could not imagine, because math was my worst subject in school, I could not imagine going through this with a child.
I remember having a conversation with, I can't remember which child of it. I want to say it's my oldest child, with her math teacher, about Common Core math, which I don't even know if they currently still do it because we're well beyond that at this point, but just arguing with the teacher because of how you had to do it. You couldn't just have an answer. You had to like prove three ways to not get an answer, to get it, all this other stuff. And I remember the teacher looking at me going, look, I hate this too, but we have to do it now. So this is something that hit me so freaking hard. It made me laugh. It made my wife roll her eyes because she's like, just, honey, just go along with it. And I am not a go along to get along type of person.
Nope.
Oh, my God. This was little stuff like this. It doesn't need to be the whole movie, but it's what makes it feel relevant to the people that are watching it.
Yeah, especially 2 years later when you had COVID and you had to go through new math, you know.
It's a commentary on the first one of removing exceptionalism. Everyone has to be uniform. You have to problem solve the exact same way as everyone else. And I read that as the perspective of not me as a parent. This was me as a student because math and I do not have a strong relationship whatsoever. I would put it as it's complicated on Facebook. Because I utterly detest it, and it was my worst subject by far.
I have a child that's taking advanced placement math classes, and I'm like, I don't know where you get this from. Just ask Uncle Garrett, it ain't your dad.
My degree is in English, sir, not advanced math.
So Bob is also having the struggle with a baby who does not want to go to sleep, and it's revealed that Jack-Jack actually indeed, we know he has powers, but this is the first time the family realizes it. And I have this problem. This carries over from the first one. I don't like that Jack-Jack has, like, infinite powers. I like that everyone else seems to have just one, but for some reason he's got, like, five.
Yeah, we get a half-assed explanation later that makes no sense. Now, if when your power started to manifest, you had different powers until one stuck, that'd be one thing, but everybody would know it. You know, and I feel like Edna kind of says that later on that, you know, he's trying to find out who he's going to be. And that's something that comes up later as well. That's just a moment of somebody trying to push something in. It makes no sense as to why, because nobody else seems to have multiple powers. And if everybody had multiple powers till one settled, that'd be one thing. But this doesn't go anywhere other than, hey, cool, look what we can animate.
You talk about scenes going on way too long. This fight with the raccoon. You could have cut this from the entire movie, and it would have been better for it.
My favorite part of the movie.
Oh,
right here. This is my favorite part.
This is this fight with the raccoon. Make this a Disney Channel short and cut it out of the movie.
This is glorious. I'm not going to rip on this. Because I like this kind of stuff. Like Ice Age with the little squirrel that plays with the...
Oh, God.
Yeah, it plays with the... Like, this is the kind of stuff I actually like. And when it comes to these animated films... Huh? Scrat, yeah.
The Scrat, yeah.
So, fun stuff, and I had no problems. In fact, Jack-Jack was probably my favorite part of this movie, my favorite character of this movie. And so, yeah, I had fun with this. I liked this little raccoon fight. I was smiling.
I'm okay with it. It, again, goes on too long. There's too much.
I think restraint is a word that should have been used more with these action scenes. Because they did, like, Jack-Jack shorts after the first one came out. And this
one, yep.
This would have fit into that mold more so than taking 5 minutes away from the movie when you could have focused it on actual writing.
There's another character I would cut out, but it's not Jack-Jack. The character I would have cut out is coming up here in a little bit. But yeah, the Jack-Jack stuff was fun for me.
I like how you're seeing Bob get progressively more tired.
His eyes.
Yeah, his eyes are drooping. He's got really bad 5 o'clock shadow.
I really felt for Matt in this moment with the baby.
Yeah, like this is still fresh in my mind, this period. It has not 100% gone away. So I really identified with this more so than anything else in the movie. But Bob has to suppress over the phone that he's like jealous of his wife, which begs the question, is Bob too unlikable?
Unlikable? No. Useless? Because, yeah.
Because I think what I think helps save that is the relationship with the kids. You know, when the kids come together and bind together to, when he gets some sleep and they're like, oh, Dad, we got you this and that. I think it shows that he's just a man trying to do his best. But I think he's out of his element. Like, Helen is relishing being back in her element.
Yep. Again, like last week's film, except we're switching genders.
So they cut back to Helen and Winston reveals that his big goal is to have a summit of world leaders to legalize superheroes on television. We're introduced to a bunch of other superheroes who are starting to come out of the woodwork. None of them really characters. They're just there to show off more stuff they can animate.
I remember not liking these people the first time I watched it. I like them even less this time. I get a moment that it's great. Helen has come out, so these people feel comfortable coming out. Like, I get it. I believe me, I get it. But then why animate these people looking just goofy and weird and odd? To me, it's almost more insulting that these are the people who are coming out and you decide to make them look weird.
Yeah, the animation's not consistent. They look more like the Megamind model of superheroes. Because there is a certain amount of like reality-based animation for almost everyone else. But these are really abstract with their designs.
Wow. See, again, another favorite part of mine in this movie are these characters. Especially the one who is throwing up, Reflux. He was probably my favorite. I like these characters. I like the fact that they are kind of looking up to Helen here. And they're trying to find ways to integrate into the story. You know, that's true with a lot of superheroes that aren't really explored that much. This was the only part of the movie that I really found to be a little creative, what were these characters. And so, yeah, I like these characters.
We get more conversations between Helen and Evelyn, where they're talking about how, to allude what Adam was mentioning earlier, it should be a woman's world. It's basically what these conversations about. You might as well replace Kathleen Keener with Kathleen Kennedy doing the voiceover work.
I will say, looking at the state of the world right now,
yeah.
I don't know if I could disagree at all. Mm-hmm. But that said, this is as subtle as Bob going through a freaking building, you know? It's just, it hits you over the head.
Well, it's also the same thing, Garrett, you mentioned rehash. This is the most blatant one where you have the person working for someone who ultimately is revealed to be connected to the main villain. And the only detail I like with Evelyn is that if you notice, her outfits become more and more black and white patterns every time she shows up, which is also, and she's always typically animated in the shadows, where her brother's out in the limelight. So there's more subtle things with the animation, but it should not be. If you were surprised that she's the villain, you clearly have not watched enough movies.
No, I keep waiting for it to be that it's going to be the brother because it's so obvious that it's Evil Lynn.
Yeah, or it was going to be Decker because the program got discontinued.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could have some smart ways to go or working together. Yeah, damn it, we're writing a better movie.
I mean, we've done it before. It's not like it's new to us.
Yeah.
So she goes on a TV interview where it's interrupted by Screenslaver, and she has to track him down using the cameras that were embedded into their new supersuits, which is a plot point that'll come up a little bit later. And this movie was noted for putting out warnings that if you were prone to epilepsy or seizures,
yeah,
this could cause some issues.
I remember.
Yeah, I remember this being a big thing, too. And I will say, again, broken record here, but the animation here is glorious. There are some times when I actually find it's like real footage. Like it looks so real that it's almost too real. But yeah, this scene was fun.
Yeah, and this is where the disconnect with Screenslaver really is, where he/she monologues about our dependency on technology and screens. You don't play games, you watch game shows. This is all good, but it doesn't match her actual motivation.
This monologue here, this pseudo-villain monologue, isn't the point, but it should be.
This is everything Syndrome made fun of in the first movie, of just stupidly monologuing. I do love it. She breaks into John Doe's house apartment from 7. And she fights who we believe is Screenslaver, but she takes him down, and it's this hypnotized pizza delivery man, as we find out. So the killer's still out there. And we take another 20 to 25 minutes for it to be revealed, which is also a problem.
Big problem.
But they wait way too long to do the whole, you know, Vince McMahon being the higher power reveal. They shoehorn Edna into the movie.
Okay. I am so glad you called that out because that was the character I was talking about. You talk about somebody who has no business being here. And I get it. You know, she was a really liked character last time. She was a part of the advertising. And this is Brad Bird doing the voice again. I get it. But at the same time, there had to have been a better way to write her in or just leave her the fuck out. Like, this is really, yeah, you talk about shoehorn. I don't use the shoehorn on my foot at night as much as Brad Bird did in getting this character in.
Well, I wonder if part of the agreement was he put the character in the movie and was reluctant to do so. Like, if that was a Disney mandate.
I don't know if it was a Disney mandate or if it's just somebody who, you know, saw that this character was popular and put her in. It's a pandering type maneuver that Disney is very prone to.
Yeah, I just think you could have, if you, she should have been nothing but a commercial on TV for Edna Mode's something. My issue is they redo what they did last film, where she was going through all the suits to explain everybody's powers, and it was a very exposition.
It was a tech demo.
Yeah, you know, so it was that dump, it was there. And they do the same thing, but just with Jack-Jack this time. Okay, we're going to animate all this different stuff to show you the different suits. You just did the same thing you did last film.
They even use the same shots of them walking down the hallway.
Her
doing all the different identification things to get into the room, them sitting down in the chairs and watching through the glass. Like, this is the most blatant rehash.
Make this a Disney Channel miniseries of Aunt Edna babysitting. You know, do it that way. Great. Fine. It doesn't belong here.
The only joke I like is how she's mad about, like, this cheap imitator that made Elastigirl's new suit.
Yeah, which I guess was supposed to be a big scene. That got amazing that they actually found something to cut out of this film, because it doesn't feel like they cut anything. But I guess it was supposed to be this big deal about this new designer who made her a suit and at one point had a cape and everything else. And of all the things to cut, I almost could have enjoyed that one.
Under the agreement that she won't charge him, but they get exclusive rights to her doing the suits, so he agrees. Cut back to... I did skip over part of the part with Bob and his family. He tries to hook Violet up with Tony again at the restaurant.
I've been to this restaurant.
Oh, and her fucking... The water coming out of her nose, that is one of the most perfectly animated sequences that Pixar has ever done. Just that 5-second frame, I kind of want that put on above my desk.
That gift has been the best thing to come out of this movie, because it's still used to this day.
So Helen realizes something's not right about the person they put away as the screenslaver. Evelyn goes in to check on her, and they talk about how the suit camera was supposed to be closed circuit. This is the It's Me, Austin reveal 20 minutes after it should have happened.
Yeah.
It was me all along, James. How did you not know?
And again, like, just Disney did this for, and Pixar did this, like, going all the way back to, I guess technically Atlantis was the first, like, twist villain with the mercenaries. Yeah. You could argue Gaston, but he's a scumbag to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But this started a trend.
But they just did this in Up.
Well, Up was one that did it. Lotso and Prospector were twist villains. Wreck-It Ralph with King Candy. Trying to think, Big Hero 6 did it. Which, that's the one thing, like, that is a better Incredibles sequel than this, in a lot of ways. That movie does the same thing, where it's two suspects for a masked villain, and it's the one that's more likely is the one they go with. Zootopia did it, Moana did it, Coco did it.
And it's just impossible to not think of Catherine Keener in Get Out when this is revealed.
Well, yeah, because that also involves mind control.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's by the time this movie came out, that trope was already well worn out. I mean,
I
think Frozen was the one that exposed it, where people are like, okay, we got to stop doing this, and then they continue to do it for another 5 years.
And I think that can be a problem when you have some of these animation movies, and Pixar being the worst, where they will take 4, 5, 6 years to make a movie. You know, well, guess what? A lot of other movies are coming out in that time frame, and you can wear out a welcome on something. You know, if this was done in a proper sequel-ish time frame, even if it was done 8 years after instead of 14, it could have hit maybe a little different. I think it maybe would have been written better, but it's just, you know what? You take so long to make something done because you're so precious about it. You're behind the time at that point.
I mean, speaking of behind the time, when we cut back to Helen, the only creative thing Tim Story did in his Fantastic Four movie was freeze Reed Richards to a chair in a cryogenic room. And Evelyn talks about, you know, this is the big villain monologue, but it's not consistent with anything the screenslaver is doing, so why did you even bother with creating a secret identity as a supervillain?
It's so, yeah, it's so stupid. It is so disconnected. And that's why I say that there was just not enough time put in the writing room as there was put into the animation. I think this is a technically well-made movie, but we are exposing it. This plot, especially when we get towards the end here, is a mess.
I guarantee you that Brad Bird, you know, the whole thing about her technology would become sentient. I think the reason why he changed that is because Wall-E did the same thing. at the end.
See, I never saw Wally, so I don't know.
Well, that has a thing where the thing, like the technology that runs the ship, becomes sentient.
Okay.
Yeah, so she mentions that her big plan is to sabotage the summit to ruin the reputation of superheroes, where she could have done this by just brainwashing all of them. Or just keep them outlawed.
Or just, I don't know, clearly you can control everybody with your TV program, Outer Limits ripoff. Just do it then.
Oh, Batman Forever ripoff.
I think if you look at her resume before they started this company, she listed Silver Shamrock.
Like, literally, you could put out a commercial that would mind control people, and that's all it would take. So, yeah, Garrett, you hit it, and Matt, you've hit it. The disconnect between everything regarding Screenslaver and what we get for the rest of this film, which seems like it takes just as long to finish the last third as it did to get through the first two thirds, it's a separate entity.
Yeah, this was the thing that really needed the biggest overhaul, and I think is the biggest victim of Toy Story 4 being accelerated.
Okay, I will say this about the mind control. Yes, it's stupid, but I think the idea, and I used to have nightmares about this, about like my parents turning on me and trying to attack and kill me. Now, they don't go that far, obviously. This is a Pixar movie, and so they're not that threatening once the kids get involved. But I'll say that that is kind of disturbing. And as somebody who has been scared of that since, you know, when he was a kid, like I when I think about this, it does kind of make me uneasy. I think I talked about this when we did The Shining all those years ago. It's a scary thing, and I do think they are hitting on something here. But again, undeveloped and very, very off the cuff as it feels. It doesn't really work in the grand scheme of things. But as a foil for these kids to get over, I do think that's semi-frightening.
Well, I like the rationale of the kids having to save the day, but they don't, pardon the pun, they don't let that run to its fullest extent.
No, especially since, like as you guys have said, Dash is pretty much non-existent in this movie.
I like the scene here at the house. I like Frozone showing up to, you know, to try to save the kids. Even the Incredicar, Incredimobile, whatever they keep calling it. I think it's a fun little scene. You know, the voice activation. They got little moments in here that keep it propelled. I still can't go with this gang that's attacking them. But I like Frozone trying to stop it. And then he gets, you know, his own. The action is good. You know, when it brings me in, cool. This 3, 5, 6 minutes, this really works. Everything surrounding it doesn't. But in moments, yeah, it brings me right back in. I'm like, woo!
Yeah, the Incredibile, which is the fantastic car.
Yeah.
Almost to the look this time, too, with the colors.
Like, they got right down to the color. I think that's why they made the Incredible suits red instead of blue, like the Fantastic Four, so they didn't get outright sued. I mean, speaking of Bond, this thing has the Lotus feature from The Spy Who Loved Me, where it turns into a boat.
Yep.
I have fun with Dash not realizing, just mouthing off. I'm like, you know, can we follow this boat? Follow boat. I am laughing and enjoying this. Does it have an ejector seat? Ejector seat active. I have little funs with this moment.
No, I have fun with the semantics of details of tropes like that. But I really like the whole climax was the kids having to do everything. Because the parents get de-goggled with like 15 minutes left to go.
I check the time and I'm like, how is there this much time left in this finale? Like, we get to the boat with like 30 minutes left in this movie.
Yeah. And
then the kids get there and it's like 20, 25. And I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah. As scary as this foil is, it doesn't last very long.
So the summit is interrupted by the heroes that are goggled. They forced to give the speech about how we're in it for ourselves now to really turn the perception. And the boat gets turned around to crash into the city, which, yeah, would cause mass destruction to a certain extent, but it's not like dropping a bomb where you'd wipe everyone out. I mean, is the plan just to kill a couple people?
Someone call Sandra Bullock.
Oh my god, this, I mean, it makes sense because this script feels like it's on cruise control for most of it.
Oh, shit. Yeah,
everybody, that was better writing than this film.
No, I'm not going that far.
I mean those lines.
I do respect the fact that we're not saving the world as the superhero films were doing around that time, but this whole crash, I guess I can go with this. I have no real issues with this. It's just everything surrounding it that I'm having a big issue with.
So the kids sneak on the boat. They have to fight the other superheroes that have been hypnotized. This is where we get more stuff with Jack-Jack, where, yeah, we know that he can go through other dimensions, but he can also change his size.
You six, Jack, Jack.
And again, this was some of my favorite stuff of the movie, is them discovering Jack-Jack's powers. And you're right, Matt, it makes no sense that as how many powers as he has, but I think that's kind of the point. I think that's why Mr. Incredible is looking at him like, dude, how much do you fucking have? Like, what am I dealing with here? And that was the part that I really did like. It was my favorite stuff of the movie, honestly, was the relationship between Mr. Incredible and Jack-Jack. And how Mr. Incredible is discovering this, and then eventually the whole family discovers it. So this stuff I found pretty fun.
And we've had this climax, it's on land with the car, we have it on sea, and then it goes to air because she fights Evelyn in the cockpit of the plane while they're trying to stop the boat. You know, they have to throw Mr. Incredible underwater after they get degoggled. But it's cool, but it's not impressive because it's great animation, but I don't feel like anyone's in any real danger. Kind of like I did in the first one, because they never acknowledged that. Like, there's not that sense of death outside of the parent getting shot in that flashback. I don't feel like anyone's really in danger.
No, in that first one, we saw so many superheroes that had been killed. In this one, people get masks put on and taken off. And that's kind of the extent of who gets hurt. You know, they get goggles put on and then goggles taken off. And, you know, pizza driver gets a mask put on and taken off. Nobody, yeah.
Yeah, again, we're using the trope of mind control because we don't want to have our heroes be convinced to do what they're doing here. So the trope of mind control, the laziness behind that is what's doing all this damage. And you're right, it's not that much damage because most of the time the kids just reach up and get rid of the goggles and that's the end of it. Oh my God, I was so fucking disappointed in this movie, boys. I was so disappointed in the way the villain's plot unfolds. And this was not working for me, this whole climax. It's fun. It's very, the animation, as you said, Matt, very good. But you're right. There's just no real escalation or danger going on here.
There's no lingering effects. You know, people have seen, you know, the public never believes that they've actually done these things. The people that see it immediately understand what's going on the second those goggles are taken off. So any sense of danger, any sense of, you know, the villain's plans come into fruition are eradicated the second they come into play. It's like a light switch being turned on and off.
So they managed to close in, save the boat. Evelyn, I think they were going to repeat the thing of the villain being sucked into a jet engine, but I guess that was a step too far because she gets captured and arrested. And it turns out that this has changed public perception so much that superheroes are given their legal status once again. And we have an epilogue where they finally manage to have their date, but they leave Tony at the theater because they see a police chase. So they put on their masks and go off to save the day once again. So how do we feel about this last couple of minutes?
Well, we had Underminer at the end of the last film, and I do kind of like the imagery of all of them being comfortable putting these masks on, including Jack-Jack. I didn't have any real problems with the final frames of this. I just wish it would have come about 20 minutes earlier.
I think there's something missing in the middle of this movie, because to me, this is Violet deciding she's going to be her own person out there, figuring out who she is as a girl, as a woman, going on a date with Tony, and being a part of the superhero family. But that wasn't a conflict in this movie, but it sure could have been. There's something there.
The thing that's missing is a conversation with her mom about you inspired me to put myself out there.
Yeah.
Adam, you have a teenager. You know damn well this is fucking conflict.
but there should have been, you know, I'm not going to be part of this. I want to go do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's with dad, with mom, there needs to be that conversation as to, you know, I'm not a superhero. I'm a teenager. And then at the end, realizing she's both. She's all of it. She's whatever she wants to be. Like you have the ending of a story that you never told.
Speaking of endings, that does it for our review of The Incredibles 2. Much livelier than I thought it would be, although I shouldn't be surprised. I have a feeling our score is going to be all over the place. So on a scale of 1 to 10, Adam, what do you give Incredibles 2?
I knew this discussion was going to be, much like the movie, more animated than the first one, but I didn't expect it to be this animated. We've beat this movie up quite a bit. And I think part of the reason we did that is because the love we have for that original Incredibles movie. This movie isn't bad, but the potential for what this movie could have been, I think, is one of its biggest downfalls because the animation has gotten amazingly fluid and beautiful, and that art department and animators worked tirelessly to make this movie look gorgeous. I wish the writing was up to par. Haha. You know, oh God, I'm embarrassed with myself. Ashamed of myself. I wish it was up to par with the animation, but it's just not. There's some good ideas there, but they're not followed through. There's conflict set up that doesn't pay off. There's a screenslaver idea that never plays into the finale of this film. It's kind of tied in, kind of not. It's almost like maybe Evil Inn's ideas went sentient and they became the goggles. Who knows? But it's not here at the end. It's a fine sequel. The thing is, it's better than a lot of Pixar sequels, but that doesn't mean it's a good movie. I will say I enjoyed this movie more this time than when I watched it in the theaters. And maybe that's because I'm a little older. So even some of the stuff that hit there hit a little more now, and I enjoy that. Watching it in close succession is almost the worst way to watch this, because that first movie is almost flawless in its design. And this one, it's a shame to see what Disney brass has done to Pixar Studios, because this one is just, it's got a lot of holes, you know, over it. You know, you got a portal person here making holes, and this has got holes all through the script. I don't want to, I can't give it a bad score because it's still enjoyable. There's still a lot of good. I'm going to give it a 7, and I think I'm being generous that way, but it still should have been so much better. But there is enough in here to enjoy that it's still a good movie. It's an okay movie, but it's nowhere near what we got in the first one. So I'm going to be generous. I'm going to give it a 7. Just don't expect Incredibles 1.
Don't expect Incredibles 1. Well, Garrett, I certainly don't think he was expecting the first one, but I'm curious to hear where you stood. So what's your score?
First of all, I have a little bit of business to take care of. I think I was a little too kind to last week's film in that I felt it had a lot to say when it really wasn't as creative as I thought it was at that time. So I want to dock it half a point. So that's a 7.5. Now getting to this movie, last week's movie, they were incredible. This week, they're barely credible. This movie was such a disappointment watching it. And the thing is, I don't really know who to blame. I don't know if it's Disney brass. I don't believe in conspiracy theories when it comes to that stuff. I don't know if it's Brad Bird. I definitely don't think it's animators. As Adam, as we've pointed out this entire podcast, they really did their jobs on this. It's just a gorgeous, more fluid animation than I've ever seen in a Pixar movie or in any animated movie, quite honestly. But that being said, I just wish the story and the screenplay matched what they put on screen. The ending of this movie is a mess. The villain of this movie is not very well built up. My favorite parts of this movie, as I mentioned, was Jack-Jack. I thought those scenes were very fun. I think there are some great jokes here, as I mentioned in the beginning, dealing with the apartment and whatnot. I think when they get into the house and they're so amazed after being in that hotel for as long as they were, I think a lot of that stuff in the house initially is fun. But once we get to the plot, it unravels, and it unravels fast. So I feel bad, but this is just an average movie for me, and Pixar does average better than most. So I'm going to be pretty kind and give it a 6, because I do think there's some stuff here that is really worth your time. I'm not sure if it's worth 2 hours of your time, but if you can sit and you really, really enjoyed last week's movie, you might get some kicks out of this. I had a few laughs, but it wasn't that enjoyable to watch. So 6 out of 10, the softest 6 I've ever given to The Incredibles 2.
So I always think when you judge a sequel, it's borderline impossible to avoid comparing it to its predecessor. In fact, I would argue it's unavoidable. And when you have a movie that struck a chord with me in particular, you know, I gave the last movie a 10, so I hold it in the utmost of high esteem. I knew it was going to be a tall task for this movie to match those heights. And ultimately, for something that took 14 years to come out, they should have waited one more year to really flesh this out and make it as incredible, pardon the pun, as it could have been. I do think there's a lot of strong elements here. I do think everything with Elastic Girl does not feel like a cheap rehash or a subversion. I think there is actually a lot to be taken from her story, and with her at the forefront, leaving Bob to be that stay-at-home parent. I think that stuff I really respond to, the superhero and the everyman. I think both those aspects play for those portions. Once you get to the third act, it becomes a conventional superhero movie in a way that the first one never really did. You could argue that's because of just the onslaught of films in the genre in the 14 years since, but I also think it's undermined, no pun intended, by a studio not prioritizing this to its utmost potential. I think everything with Screenslaver is sloppy and poor, and much like Comparison, you know, Syndrome is in the upper echelon of villains. This is towards the bottom, and a lot of superhero movies are defined by their villains, and this is unfortunately a low-tier take on what this character could have been. I think there is something here, but it's a tug of war. I have the same score written down as one of you, and I'm going to side with Adam. I do think this is a above par movie. Again, no pun intended, but I'd be lying to you if I said this was not a disappointment. There's more I respond to now that I've gotten older, and certainly some stuff hits pretty hard because I've lived it recently, but I'm going to give it a 7 on 10. You know, I think it's good. I sounded a lot harsher on it than I actually am, but a lot of that is just because of how much I put the first movie on a pedestal.
Think about it, guys. It was 16 years between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace. This was 14. This was only 2 years shy of that span, and this is what they came up with?
Yeah, Phantom Menace is what they came up with.
I don't know. I gave it about the same score. So actually, no, Phantom Menace was 1 point above. But you know what I'm saying? Like, to come back and turn this out is quite a shame.
And I think we all fell because of how great we felt that first one was. Yeah. Comparison is the thief of joy. And yep.
So let's answer the ultimate question. Do you want a third one? Do you want a third one?
No, and I don't think Brad Bird does either. I don't see him coming back to this. I don't see them continuing this unless it's on Disney Plus with certain animated specials and things, which I'm sure they're going to do and what they probably have done. I don't want any more of the Incredibles family. I thought the first one was fun enough, but after sitting through this, I don't think I want any more. And I got to be honest, guys. I thought this was going to be a real war. I thought I was going to come on here and I was going to be fighting you guys tooth and nail because I didn't think you guys would be as harsh on it as you were, but I gotta say, after watching this, no more. Just let it die. Although it made over $1 billion, I've seen the box office grosses of this, so far be it from us to judge them.
So I want one?
Go ahead.
I don't know. Like, I could see a world where I would be okay with it, but it would depend on what they would tell us. Do I think we're going to get one? Absolutely, I think we're going to get one. I think Disney's investment in adding Incredibles to the theme parks, not temporarily, but completely redesigning rides to make them incredible rides, mean that we're going to get more in this. I think maybe you tell one where, not in college, but give me Violet as a senior, Jack is a freshman, so they're both in school at the same time, something that I'm about to be dealing with here pretty soon, and just that changing family dynamic, maybe one of them is sick or loses their powers or passes away. Like, you're going to go back to tropes, but this series has been tropes throughout. I just think you could tell a heartfelt story and make it really work. We'll see. It's going to happen. We'll just see when it actually does. There's no way that you make a $1 billion grossing movie and let it go. It's not Captain Marvel.
So not only do I think a third movie will happen, I think it's actually necessary, and I'll say why. There is a huge story to be told based on where the second one ends. And that is, if Jack-Jack becomes the villain of the third movie, you let enough time pass, and you sort of treat him like the Dark Phoenix, where he is the Omega-level super in this continuity, because no one else has multiple powers, and you age it up enough to where a considerable amount of time has passed that they have to deal with that. So that'd be my pitch.
I don't know, man. You turn the kids against the parents. Man, that's a tough sell.
Not that hard of sell.
Because I think the third one is about like Jack-Jack being the, if not the villain, he is the focal point of the third movie. Especially with like how much of an anomaly having multiple powers is. But I do think if you make a third one, set it 4 or 5 years in the future. because Dash is what, like 10?
Don't synthesize it up again. Don't have them be the exact same age. That would be stupid.
Yeah,
you got to age it up.
But that'd be my thought process as well. And Pixar has shown, or I should say, we've seen other properties where you bring in another director and they make it work. So I don't think it's one of those things where Brad Bird is a requirement, but if he does come back, let him actually write the movie. Like, I don't feel like this is 100% his movie, like I did with the first one.
I don't know, man. He stood by it and all the press and everything up to this. Like, he said this was what he wanted to make, so I don't agree with that logic. I think this is all Brad Bird. I just don't think he has it in him to do something as innovative as he did last week.
He hasn't done anything since this one, right? But I think he's been, for a director who's done live action and animation, I think that's kind of a, well, maybe he's been working on it the whole time.
But yeah, we'll see. But I think the chances are better than not that we get a third.
All right, Matt, what's coming up next? What do we have going on? We did our 2 week stint of The Incredibles. We got to have something very, very innovative coming up, right?
Yeah, it's called Incredibles 3.
I'm talking about on the site, sir.
Yeah, we're not going back to The Incredibles until they make a third movie, so this will be relatively dormant. So, Garrett, you're getting your wish for going back to Stephen King.
Finally!
Jeez. So Adam and I will bite our lips and clench our fists in anger as we have to close out Night Shift, except for Children of the Corn. So we got to do Graveyard Shift, The Manglers, The Lawnmower Men, and our break from that will be reviewing the new Ghostbusters movie.
We have a long couple months coming up, boy.
Talk about a graveyard shift.
Yeah, graveyard shit. Oh, God. I don't know which one I'm dreading more.
Well, we could do Adam's Wish and do Transcendence. It's a side-by-side with Lawnmower Man.
Look forward to that more than fucking whatever the Ghostbusters Frozen Ever After is going to be.
Gosh, yeah, I mean, that looks awful.
Are we sure that like Elsa is not going to show up in that movie? Because they said Walter Peck's coming back because they're so desperate to please the fans of the original.
Wow, jeez.
Yeah, so as you all can tell, I give no fucks about this new Ghostbusters movie. In fact, I have no desire to see it.
I tell you what, my fiance does. She really wants to see it. She was excited when she saw the trailer. So
I was excited too until I realized it was a Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be like some new horror movie. Like I thought it was the sequel to The Day After Tomorrow. They should have called it The Day Before Yesterday.
I saw the trailer in a theater recently, and people I hate cheering for trailers, but people cheered when that trailer came up. Oh, my God.
I hate cheering for movies, period.
All right. Well, until next week when we review the first of our King return with Graveyard Shift. Done properly, podcasting is a heroic act. Done properly. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
We didn't start this fight.
Well, you didn't finish it either.
Did you stop the Underminer from inflicting more damage?
No.
Did you stop him from robbing the banks?
No.
Did you catch him?
No.
The banks were insured. We have infrastructure in place to deal with these matters. If you had simply done nothing, everything would now be proceeding in an orderly fashion.
You'd have preferred we do nothing?
Without a doubt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
Thank you, Mr. Incredible. You've done it again.
Yeah, you're the best.
No, I'm just here to help.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
I'm taking in information. I'm processing.
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to www.percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access the Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of franchises such as Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, Top Gun, the Batman DC films, Superman, and so many more.
We appreciate what you did in the old days, but those days are over.
Too much of it, darling. Too much. That is why I show you my work. That is why you are here.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
I'm your number one fan!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
What is the main reason you were all forced underground?
Ignorance.
Perception.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
That was incredible. I mean, no pun intended.
Sorry, Ed.
When was the last time you slept?
Who keeps track of that?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Hey, you see that?
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
That's old school.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Nice of you to drop by.
Ha! Never heard that one before.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
No matter how many times you save the world, it always manages to get back in jeopardy again. I mean, sometimes I just want it to stay saved, you know, for a little bit. I feel like the maid. I just cleaned up this mess. Can we keep it clean?
Yeah, countdown, and then we'll get rolling.
Well, you're doing the countdown, because I'm...
Oh, that's right. All right. 3, 2, and 1. I have never seen A Bug's Life, but I tell you... And yeah, I know. I tell you who really champions that film is my future wife. She loves it. One of these nights, we're going to sit down, we're going to watch it together, but she's been clamoring for a sequel to that since that first movie was released. And so, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever see it, but I know it has at least one champion.
I liked it better when it was called Seven Samurai, and I'll leave it at that. And I don't think...
You know what, that came out the same year as Ants. I remember that battling... Sylvester at the box office that summer.
As somebody who worked at a video store that year, oh yeah, I remember that too.
We don't have A Bug's Life. Would you like to watch Ants?
Yes.
The answer is yes, because Ants is a considerably better movie.
I will never seen either.
I'll put that out there now.
Coming soon to Percolated Media.
If we ever do a DreamWorks retrospective, that's the first one out of the gate.
Yeah.
Every sequel took the side character and flipped it. Every single one. You know, Toy Story 2 was sudden, or not Toy Story 2, but Cars 2 was suddenly about Mater.
Yeah, that's like a very Bond type of reference.
Oh yeah, that's like Holly Goodhead.
You know, but let me see, how old is my 12? So far? Yeah, my 8-year-old.
I thought these scenes were like one scene of Mr. Incredible. What's the name of the baby again?
Jack-Jack.
Okay. I thought this scene was one scene.
So Helen goes to, what's the name of the, New Urban, but not without.
That's just a half-baked, half-assed, and somebody wanting to, Disney woke moment of, you know what, cut that out. Just a moment. But I think he's out of his element. Like, Helen is relishing being back in her element.
Yep. Again, like last week's film, except we're switching genders.
Well, what happens next? Oh, so. But they wait too long to do the whole, you know, Vince McMahon being the higher power reveal. Which could be worse. I mean, there could have been defecation in this movie if it was Vince McMahon, apparently.
Oh, jeez.
Well, speaking of shit, I think the reason why he changed that is because Wally did the same thing at the end.
See, I never saw Wally, so I don't know.
Well, that has a thing where the thing, like the technology that runs the ship, becomes sentient.
Okay.
You know what? You and Jen need to make that one a date night.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Have you seen
that and Bug
Have you seen Up at least?
Yes, I've seen Up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw it in theaters actually. Yeah, at the drive-in actually.
Because like it's weird that you haven't seen. It's a lot of Pixar movies you haven't seen. Have you seen Monsters? No,
it's like you guys do. So
yeah, that's fine. You don't have to be a kid to watch Pixar movies.
Mm.
But you have to be brain dead to like the Cars movies. I'll say that.
Damn.
Jeez. Wow, shot across the bow. Man.
Especially Cars 2. Like, I don't understand.
Cars 2, I'll agree with. Oh, Cars 2 is a Bond movie. That's what that one is.
Yeah, it's the fucking View to a Kill of Cars movies, then. Yeah, so she mentions that.
All right, let's take 5 and come back. Adam, do you have to go to work? I don't even know your days off anymore.
I'm off.
Okay, all right, so come back and we'll go through Planet 3 and we'll be done.
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
We recorded Graveyard Shift, right? It's Mango.
Yes, you've already done that okay. One.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's what
you did. It's already edited, actually. I just have to put the intro and outro together. But yeah, it's done.
I'm looking at my notes. I'm like, wait a minute. Why do I cross this out?
Yeah, okay. Next week will be the Mangler.
Right, oh, joy.
You're going to be wishing for Graveyard Shift next week, sir.
Yeah, so it's...
All right.
All right, take 5.